Robert Tom. Tan. Hanyamanam. Abhiviksha. Guyakan. Tan hanyamanam abhiviksha guyakan. Angasas. Sorry. Anagasas. Chitra. Ratena. Burisa. Anagasas chitra ratena burisa. Anutanapadim. Autanapadim. Kripaya. Pitamaho. Autanapadim kripaya pitamaho. Manur. Jagadopagata. Saharshivi. Manur jagado pagata saharshivi. Tanhanyamanam abhiviksha guyakan. Anagasas chitra ratena burisha. Otanapadim kripaya pitamaho. Manur jagad. Manur jagado pagata saharshibi. Tan hanyamanam abhiviksha guyakan. Anagasas chitra ratena burisha. Autanapadim kripaya pitamaho. Manur jagod. Manur jagado pagata saharshibi. Tanhanyamanam abhiviksha guyakan. Anagasas chitra ratena burisa. Tanapadim kripaya pitamaho. Manur jagado pagata saharshibi.
Ladies.
Hanyamanam adiriksha bhuyagam
Nagasaschi
praratena bhurisha
Tanapadim kripaya pitamaho
Manogata bhagata saharsivi
Tanayamanam adiriksha bhuyagam
Anagasas-chitra-yatena-bhurisha
Tan,
those yakshas,
Hanyamanam,
being killed,
Abhiviksya,
seeing,
Guyakan,
the yakshas,
Anagasa,
offenseless,
Chitraratena,
by Dhruva Maharaj,
who had a beautiful chariot,
Burisaha,
greatly,
Uttanapadam,
unto the son of Uttanapada.
Kripaya,
out of mercy.
Pitamaha,
the grandfather.
Manu,
Svayambhuva
Manu.
Jagada,
gave instructions.
Upagata,
approached.
Saharishibi,
with great sages.
Translation of purport by His Divine Grace
Prabhupada.
When Svayambhuva Manu saw that his grandson Dhruva Maharaj was killing so many of the yakshas who were not actually offenders, out of his great compassion he approached Dhruva with great sages to give him good instruction. Purport. Dhruva Maharaj attacked Alakapuri, the city of the yakshas, because his brother was killed by one of them. Actually, only one of the citizens, not all of them, were guilty of killing his brother, Uttama. Dhruva Maharaj, of course, took a very serious step when his brother was killed by the yakshas. War was declared and the fighting was going on. This sometimes happens in present days also. For one man's fault, a whole state is sometimes attacked. This kind of wholesale attack is not approved by Manu, the father and lawgiver of the human race. He therefore wanted to stop his grandson Dhruva from continuing to kill the Yaksha citizens who were not offenders.
Amaginatam randasya kinanjana shalakaya chakshurum ritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chitanya manobishtam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam dadati svapadantikam vandeham shri guru shri yuta padakamalam shri gurun vaishnavam cha shri rupam sagra jatam sahagana raganatan vitam tam sajivam sadvetam savadutam parijana saitam krishna chaitanya devam shri radha krishna padan sahagana lalita shri vishakanvitam cha Hey Krishna, Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jigatpate, Gopeshi Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute, Tapta Kanchana Gorange, Radhe Vrindavanishvare, Vrishabhana Sita Devi, Panamami Haripriye, Vanchakalpatrubhyascha, Kripa Sindhu Bhyevacha, Patitanam Bhavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha, Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivas Adigor Bhaktivinda, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
So we can see Dhruva Maharaj, he kind of overstepped the mark a little bit, and some people might think he overstepped the mark a lot. You know, nowadays you get called a war criminal or something, or calls for prosecution or whatever. But we're talking about the days of yore, the days of old. And so Dhruva Maharaj just got carried away, and he started to attack everybody very powerfully. And Manu is like Svayambhuva Manu is he can see that okay, this is getting out of hand, and he doesn't want his grandson to be guilty of such offenses. So he comes with other great sages to speak to Dhruva, and when Dhruva sees them coming, then he acts appropriately, and he ceases from his activity. So Prabhupada is describing that Manu is the father and lawgiver of the human race. So there is some kind of controversy or some doubt sometimes in ISKCON about Manu and Manu Samhita, and what is our position regarding that. So in Prabhupada speaks a lot about this, and there was one purport I came across this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, and Prabhupada says, he's speaking about Maharaj Parikshit. The real qualification is to become a devotee of the Lord, and gradually all the good qualities worthy of possession develop. Maharaj Parikshit was a Mahabhagavata, or a first-class devotee, who was not only well-versed in the science of devotion, but also able to convert others to become devotees by his transcendental instructions. Maharaj Parikshit was therefore a devotee of the first order, and thus he used to consult great sages and learned Brahmins who could advise him by the Shastras how to execute the state administration. One thing I found interesting in that little part there was that Prabhupada lays down Maharaj Parikshit's qualifications, Mahabhagavata, perfect, pure devotee. And so then he says, therefore, as a devotee of the first order, he used to consult great sages and learned brahmanas. So I found that was interesting, because sometimes we think that, you know, once you've reached that topmost exalted position, then you don't need anybody else. You know, you've already reached it, you're at the top, you're at the pinnacle. Why do you need any help? But we see here that actually one of the qualifications of being such a person is that you want to do this. You want to hear from the great brahmanas. It's not as if they will necessarily come up with something you don't know, but by presenting Bhagavatam from different perspectives, you get to hear something you may have heard before from a different point of view, and it can trigger different realizations. So in this way, the devotees love to do this. They love to hear the realizations of the other devotees, and then in this way, especially in a person in Parikshit Maharaj's case, come out with a very good conclusion, a very good course of action. So, I'll continue with the purport. Such great kings were more responsible than modern elected executive heads, because they obliged the great authorities by following their instructions left in the Vedic literatures. So again, we see that these great authorities, such as Parikshit Maharaj, they considered these Vedic authorities to be valid now, today. Even though they may have been written thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago, they are valid. Prabhupada says here, they're still valid. Then Prabhupada says, there was no need for impractical fools to enact daily a new legislative bill and to conveniently alter it again and again to serve some purpose. The rules and regulations were already set forth by great sages like Manu, Yajnavalkya, Parashara, and other liberated sages, and the enactments were all suitable for all ages in all places. So there's another interesting thing where Prabhupada is establishing here, that these enactments, it's like a set of laws that were created millennia ago. You know, you can list them. There's not a great deal of them. And these enactments are suitable for all ages and all places. So, you know, we hear about time, place, and circumstance. And we hear that, you know, well, we have to adjust things according to time, place, and circumstance. And of course, this is a fact. We do have to adjust things according to time, place, and circumstance. But the essence of what is law, the essence of what is right and wrong for human beings, that doesn't change. That'll never change. Because human beings will always be governed by the same set of emotions. We will always have the same set of characteristics in any age and any time. They may be colored. They'll be colored by some local customs or whatever. But in general, this is the case. And of course, this also has various degrees according to whether one is a Brahmin, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, or a Shudra. There will be certain colors to that also. But all of these things are taken into consideration. So this is, you know, this comes up that, well, okay, you know, it's all very well to say that Manu, you know, his rules and regulations are good for all times and all places. But if we were to enact Manu now, we'd be arrested and thrown into jail in certain cases, you know. So therefore, how can you say that this is valid for all times and places? You know, so that's, it seems to be like a contradiction, you know. It's something maybe we don't even want to think too much about because it's just too complicated. How do you work this out? So we can understand that these instructions, they're valid in all times and places. The problem is that no one cares for them. The leaders of society don't care for them. Even we don't care for them because they appear to come from a mindset which is very different to our mindset. In order for us to understand Manu's laws, we would really need to understand the mind and mood of Manu and the mind and mood in which these laws are meant to be enacted, because these laws are applicable to a society which has grown in a particular kind of culture, which Prabhupada describes as Vedic culture. So as I've mentioned before, there was one famous European philosopher who said that laws, what did he say? Without human, what's the word? Does anyone know, I've mentioned this before, Emil Durkheim his name was, and he said that without basic human customs, if people have human, the proper kind of conditioning, then laws are not required. But if people don't have that conditioning, then laws are actually unenforceable. If people have social norms, that's what it was, when the proper social norms are in place, then laws are not necessary. But when the proper social norms are not in place, laws are not applicable. They don't work. And we can see that. There are so many laws now, and yet they're being broken all the time. So what's the point in making a law if it's broken? The whole idea of a law is you're meant to follow it. And if people break them all the time, then you've wasted your time. You know, it's just a waste of everybody's time. So social norms. So the fact of the matter is that the social norms have been so disturbed and so unbalanced for so long that therefore now when we look at the laws of Manu, it's difficult for us to understand where they come from. What is all this about? Why is he saying the things he's saying? So this is a problem. Prabhupada recognized that problem. In another purport, it's just coming up in a few chapters' time, Prabhupada speaks, human society should take advantage of the instructions from both Shruti, which is the personal authority, and Smriti, the Shastras. If one wants to advance in spiritual life, he must take these instructions and follow the principles. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Srila Rupa Goswami says, that if one poses himself as advanced in spiritual life, but does not refer to the Shrutis and the Smritis, he is simply a disturbance in society. One should follow the principles laid down in the Shrutis and the Smritis, not only in one's spiritual life, but in material life as well. As far as human society is concerned, it should follow the Manu Smriti as well, for these laws are given by Manu, the father of mankind. So we can see that Prabhupada was very much in favor of us following Manu Smriti, the laws of Manu. And actually, interestingly, Prabhupada was very flexible in many ways, in the sense that ISKCON sort of transcends the mundane laws of any one particular nation, because we are present in all nations, or at least in many nations. And one time, for instance, Prabhupada was trying to establish the Gurukula in Dallas, and he was facing lots of problems with legislation. According to Shastra, there is a certain way in which brahmacharis should be trained. But American, you know, leaders would see those brahmachari training systems as being oppressive. Nowadays it would be against the rights of the child. You know, nowadays you've got the United Nations rights of the child. And such kind of systems of teaching would appear to go against these kinds of rights. So what did Prabhupada do? He said, okay, let's move it to India. Because at least in India, the leaders understand. They understand the importance of Vedic culture. And they will appreciate that, oh yes, this is our very ancient system. So therefore it's good. So the Prabhupada, you know, he wanted to move our Gurukula from America to India for that purpose. It's a very interesting thing how, for instance, here in Mayapur, we are building this temple of the Vedic Planetarium. So Prabhupada did such a unique thing. I mean, where in the world do you find such a thing as a temple and a planetarium? It's just, I mean, does anyone know of anything like that? It's like, you got a temple is a temple, that's it. You know, temples are just temples, and planetariums are planetariums. And, you know, they're just two different things, you know, especially in the West. You know, planetariums, what do you call it, astronomy, this is the preserve of scientists. You know, we're talking about rational science. Men, you know, American men, British men of strong intellect, they are astronomers, you know. And the temples or the churches, you know, these are the sentimental people who like to hold on to these kind of, you know, airy-fairy god kind of things and talk about dreamy stuff. But, you know, science, astronomy, that's the preserve of serious men. So, of course, why did Prabhupada do that? Why did Prabhupada want to create a temple of the Vedic Planetarium in ISKCON's world headquarters? It's a very strong statement Prabhupada's making. And he really wants people to see that the Vedic version of the cosmology of the universe is actually true science. This is the true science. And, you know, it all revolves, if you like, on the back of a tortoise. You know, the whole arrangement is sitting on the back of this. So, you know, it's interesting because, who was it? Prahlad Nisringa was telling me that he went to Thailand one time and he saw how the Thai government, or the king of Thailand, was very proud of his Vedic heritage. And, you know, Prabhupada was trying to do this. He was trying to wake up India to this incredible heritage that we have, that we've been given, that actually India has been the cradle of civilization. It is the original cradle of civilization, and all truth comes from India. All of the great discoveries were originally made in India and were codified in the Vedas. So, Prabhupada, it's like, you know, this is a kind of an extension of Prabhupada's boot-in-face philosophy. You know, Prabhupada never shied away from this whole thing of, you know, I put my boot in their face. He wanted to smash the scientists, and he wanted to show that they are actually the sentimental religionists, because their whole knowledge is all based on just sentimental attachment. And when their theories become disproven, it's just conveniently brushed aside and forgotten, and then the new theory is promoted. So Prabhupada, this temple of the Vedic Planetarium is a good kind of illustration of boot-in-face philosophy, that, you know, here we are, this is the home of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and in this home, in this place, we're going to show the Vedic cosmology of the universe. We're going to show how the universe has been constructed. and it's a challenge. It's a great challenge, and Prabhupada wanted that. He deliberately wanted to pose this challenge to the whole Western idea that they are superior. So, here in Mayapur, we've been given this task to build this Vedic planetarium. And along with the planetarium, we are hoping that this will trigger many questions. You know, the whole idea of this is to trigger thought. You know, what do you think about this? What is this? You know, the sun, the moon is further away than the sun. You know, they didn't go to the moon. I mean, this lays it all out on the line where we stand. So we need to also be very strong about this. So this kind of ties in with this whole thing of Manu and Vedic civilization. Because while it may be that we cannot, that we're constrained to follow Manu's laws due to the laws of the land that we're in, we may not be able to right now follow those laws. But it doesn't mean to say that the laws of the land are right and that Manu's laws are wrong. So our duty is to explain this. First of all, our duty is to understand how is it that Manu's laws are right. We have to ourselves really go deep into that and try to understand. Not everybody has to do this, but some members of the society have to look into Manu's laws and be able to explain what is it about Manu's laws that are good and why should they be followed today. The Prophet says they're valid in all times and places, circumstances. Well, maybe not circumstances, times and places. So the Vedic planetarium, Prabhupada's laying out this challenge. People will come, Prabhupada wanted people to come from all over the world to see the temple of the Veda planetarium. And he wanted us to be able to explain what it all means and what are the repercussions that this has on human society. And apart from that, there is a whole very deep life which is Vedic culture, which has many aspects to it. And when this is demonstrated, when the Vedic culture is demonstrated, when the people within that Vedic culture are acting according to their position in society, what is demonstrated is a very ideal society. So Prabhupada stresses this many times, that the Vedic times were very ideal times. Alongside the temple of the Vedic planetarium, we are, what's the word? The challenge is given to us to be able to espouse, to understand and espouse the entire, at least as much as we can, of Vedic civilization and Vedic culture. So Prabhupada described when he was writing to the planning officer of West Bengal back in, I think it was in 74, 75, something like that. And he was saying that, you know, he bumped into this planning officer in the airport in Calcutta or Delhi, I think it was. And he said, oh, it's very fortuitous. You know, Krishna's arranged that we should meet because we're developing a very wonderful project in Mayapur. He said, we have plans to become self-sufficient by producing our own cloth, having cows, this and that. And then he said, and we're planning to build a magnificent city, a magnificent international city based on this Vedic culture. So this remains a challenge, because in that sentence of magnificent international city based on Vedic culture, you know, we could easily get enamored by the first part, you know, a magnificent international city. Most of us know what an international city is. And, you know, what is magnificent? What does that mean? You know, there are different interpretations of what magnificent is. So we don't want just a magnificent international city. We want a magnificent international city based on Vedic culture. So that means we have to understand what the Vedic culture is, which means we have to understand Manu. So these are very important considerations. It's a challenge for all of us to come up to the mark. Prabhupada expected many things of us. He expected he had very high aspirations for his society. We can see, especially in the early days, you know, Prabhupada was speaking about how we have to preach to the intelligentsia, and in that way, by impressing the intelligent people, the movement can actually change the face of the earth. And that was Prabhupada's idea. He wanted to change. He wanted to bring back a very glorious chapter in Krishna conscious history. We can see at various stages how certain personalities were able to make great changes in society. For instance, at one time I went to visit Manipur a few years ago, and Manipur was who was it who went to Manipur? One of Lord Chaitanya's... Narottam Das Thakur was preaching in that part of India, eastern India. And if you go to Manipur now, you can see the very strong influence he had on the traditions of the people of that part of India. And it's really wonderful, actually, to see the... If you look at some of the... you know, Bhaktisrupa Damodar Maharaj was able to really cultivate the different artists and devotional players of Manipur. And he did these international tours. And you can really see how Narottam Das Thakur's influence was so strong and really brought out the devotion of the people. So in different ways, we can understand the influence Krishna consciousness can have. And sometimes we feel that how much influence can we really have? How much influence can I have as a person? Each of us may feel, our influence is very limited. And sometimes it seems to be against all odds. You know, the whole material world, the wave of so-called progress is washing over everybody. And it seems like, a few Hare Krishna devotees, what can we really do? But the fact of the matter is that changes in the world always start from a small group of individuals. Small group of individuals, one or two people, who are really convinced about something. If they have enough conviction, they can do so many things. So we see that Prabhupada was one such an individual who brought Krishna consciousness from India to the West. And with a small group of people in the beginning, he was able to create this worldwide society. Now we have this worldwide established society for Krishna consciousness. So established that, even we get invited to the Houses of Parliament. I mean, you can imagine, 50 years ago, there would be no question of us being in the Houses of Parliament or whatever. But now, we are able to have some kind of influence in these big governmental houses. So this is Prabhupada's conviction. Prabhupada was so convinced, he took to heart the instructions of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and he became so enthused. And Prabhupada would say that, I did this when I was 70 years old. You are young men. How much more can you do? So Prabhupada wanted anyone who would be prepared to take up this mission, take it as their life and soul, become convinced, and actually change the way people perceive the world. Prabhupada has given us, the amazing thing is Prabhupada has given us so many tools to do this. He's given so many examples in his books, and his personal life is such a great example, how he was able to actually, out of nothing in the West, create the Hare Krishna movement and make it so that it has become like a mainstream, a recognized philosophical understanding, a philosophical movement. So another thing to consider is that in a sense, the mocking of the materialists in terms of certain depictions of our philosophy, like demigods flying on flower airplanes, it's just so unbelievable as to be ridiculous, according to the materialists. In a sense, that's in our favor because, they will leave such a airy-fairy philosophy, it's not even worth considering. So the fact that the materialists are kind of so skeptical in it is in our favor because this we understand this knowledge is a very secret, it's the most secret of all secrets. And so it cannot be understood by everybody. And so in that sense, it's by personal contact. The only way any conversion comes about is by personal contact, by a person being convinced, speaking to one and another, and in this way, gradually, by reaching the right people, having an influence. So, it's interesting in, we understand that in the modern world, the whole chemical farming business has taken over everything, practically speaking. It's just all pervasive. But there are a few farmers who are going back to the old ways. And by their example, by actually showing how you can farm in a very simple way using traditional methods, when the local people see, oh yeah, actually, you know, what looks to be a crazy system actually works. And it gets, you get better yields and you get good results from this. Then they become convinced this is a good system. So this has been going on in Karnataka for some time. Some farmers there have been just showing, hey, they can do it this way. You don't have to use the chemicals. And slowly, slowly, one by one, these farmers, when they see the reality, they change. So this is the kind of way in which these revolutions take place. One by one, different people becoming convinced. And then it eventually reaches a point where it becomes like a wave. And especially by reaching the intellectual people, the intelligent people. I'm not sure how much preaching we do in these fields anymore. But when Prabhupada was with us, we used to do a lot of preaching to these people. I mean, Prabhupada himself would often be preaching to politicians and governors and so many important people, religious leaders would come to meet Srila Prabhupada. And he wouldn't compromise in his presentation of Krishna consciousness. So, I don't know if there's anything more I can say on this purport. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
Because I've never read Manu Samhita, I've never seen a copy of it, I've never read it. So I was wondering, you said, like, what does it sound like? What are the laws? Like you said, there's laws that if we enacted, we might get arrested for. So what, because I've never read it, I've never heard exactly what it says. What kind of stuff does it say?
Well, you know, it's the kind of things where you have, if a person is a thief, then he has his hands cut off, like this kind of thing. So, you know, that's considered to be barbarism. You know, in modern enlightened society, this is just barbarism. You know, how can you possibly cut off the hands of a poor man? You know, he may have been a thief, but still, I mean, that's just, oh, disgusting, too much. Now, that if you consider that one life is everything, you know, there is only one life, and, you know, that is everything, then okay, maybe it seems a little barbaric. But we have to understand that actually there are not, it's not one life, there are many lives. And it's effectively shown in countries where they do this kind of thing, at least in the past, when it was more of a pure system, that you had practically no thieves, because who's going to steal things if you get your hands cut off? It just, you know, people just don't do it. Because the law is so severe. So it's not like you get so many people get their hands cut off. Very few people get their hands cut off. And for those people, you know, this is one life in many lives, and they've learned a very important lesson in another life. When their next life, when they're born with a whole body, with hands on it, maybe they won't be a thief. So, you know, we have to see these things in terms of long term. And that's what Manu does. Manu fully understands the situation of reincarnation. And he understands how people can be controlled, and the importance of controlling people, the importance of constraining people. If you don't do this, then so many people become thieves and have to suffer. If they're not caught, they will have to suffer in so many ways. Better to be caught and punished, because the suffering is immediately finished and then you start with a clean slate. But if you can be a thief and carry on being a thief continuously, you're not punished, it's much worse than your next life. Prabhupada describes this. Prabhupada describes that a murderer, you know, if the king kills a murderer, then that person, his debt is finished. He starts his life with a clean slate. But if the person is not punished and takes birth again, then his karma will be so much worse. So, these are the kinds of considerations. So, of course, it's not that everybody has to go out and get Manu Samhita and start studying it. But those who have certain positions in the society, or those who aspire towards preaching in a certain way, it would be fruitful to do that. And at least a few people need to know how this operates, how it's important, the influence and the impact it will have on society, the benefits that will come from it, so that we can prevent, we can present convincing arguments to show that this, the Krishna conscious philosophy, the background of the Krishna consciousness philosophy is very deep and considers everything. Everything is considered, and the ultimate consideration is that it is all for the benefit of everybody. Everyone benefits from this. Everyone gains immeasurably from following this philosophy and these laws. It's the amazing thing that what Prabhupada has given us is beneficial in every way. And it actually is the source of all happiness. So if we consider it's beneficial, source of all happiness, why wouldn't we want to try to understand it, try to present it, and try to convince people that this system is better? And this is what Prabhupada is doing continuously. Yes.
Some months ago in the American University in DC, I went with my friend, my best friend, and I was very proud to show him the Srimad Bhagavatam. We found the 25 volumes of Srimad Bhagavatam, and I was showing him how beautiful is Vedic philosophy. But the next day we went there, and he showed me the Manu Samhita, and he was very impressed about some specific law was mentioned about how Shudras and Chandalas, they were very hard chastised because they tried to go to the temple or they tried to do prayers, that type of things. And it was very hard for my friend because he has, he's African American, and taking into consideration all this background about slavery, it was very hard for him to see that there is some parts about this caste system in the Manu Samhita. We know that after Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, everybody is welcome to practice Krishna consciousness, to chant the holy names, but at that time I was truly crying because I couldn't give a good explanation about the Manu Samhita at that time. I just could say that now it's completely different, but I'm not sure if it's okay to mention the Manu Samhita taking these parts. So what is your advice, please?
Well, if you can't explain it, then don't bring it up. Definitely. And it's not that everybody, as I mentioned, everybody should go out start handing out Manu Samhita on book distribution or something like that. Some people have to understand it. Some devotees, and there are devotees, Bhakti Vajrapuna Maharaj, for instance, is one who can explain very nicely many of these things. It's like an internal document, if you like. It's not for public display. And we really need to understand it ourselves. So Prabhupada gives different explanations according to time, place, and circumstance how we can understand these things. The whole thing of Shudra not being able to approach the Shastras, we understand that as devotees, when a person becomes a devotee, we're interested in Daivi Varnashram, then these considerations are transcended. So for a person who is not even a human being, because this is the other side, is that a Shudra, a proper Shudra actually comes to the human level. Most people are not even on that level. So, what to speak of being a devotee? So, there are so many different things to consider and so many different ways to explain these things, and we shouldn't even broach the subject unless we really know. So, this is why Prabhupada really wanted us to become well-versed in these things. That's a very important consideration. Who is it?
Sometimes I hear that we're ahead of schedule on this Temple of the Vedic Planetarium, construction-wise. Is that true?
Oh, I'm not actually part of the temple
okay.
team.
Well, let's take it that there's something to it. And what I'm getting at is that, to meet this incredible challenge of building a Mayapur city, building a planetarium, building some decent kind of representation of Varnashram culture, can you give us a kind of message of how we can participate in this, just realistically? Because if this monumental edifice is going up sooner than we think, this is a world-class challenge, and we've got to be ready on so many fronts, scientific, culturally, consciousness, you name it. Very soon, a lot of people are going to be coming here, more than ever. What is your message to all of us of how we can prepare for this?
Well, from what I can see, in our society, one part that we really haven't looked at sufficiently has been the Varnashram side. And Prabhupada really, you just read his books, it comes up everywhere. So, and like you say, this Temple of the Veda Planetarium will really lay down the gauntlet, and so many different questions will come on so many different levels. So it's time to, we need to put aside the time, somehow or another, put aside some time to try to understand this aspect of Vedic civilization. What does it mean? What does Vedic civilization mean? We're starting, for instance, with developing this Varnashram College over the other side next to the Gurukula. And that will start to provide some lessons, some kind of courses on what is Vedic civilization, what does a Vedic city. And those who are concerned about this maybe should get together and create a kind of a manifesto or some kind of a plan by which we can chalk out a path which would really start to demonstrate these different aspects of Vedic civilization, Vedic culture, in ways that can be done, in a step-by-step, systematic, what's the word, incremental, just take whatever small step is possible to take now and build on that. So this needs to be done. I would like to encourage anybody who wants to do that to please get together and let's make a serious proposal. Because basically anyone can make a proposal to the GBC for anything. If it's a credible proposal, it will be heard, and if it's got some good backup from Guru Sadhu Shastra. So, it's to be done.
As you say, the more... when this temple's built, it's going to provoke a lot of questions. And people are going to want to see some example of this paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
So, along with building a temple, we have to build the community to show something. Otherwise, it's going to be another fairy tale.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Yeah.
History has shown that major changes in religious nature only really prevail when the government gets behind it. Government, army, judiciary, police, etc. So, while we, and in fact, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, who was a government man, and he explained it comes from the Sun King, who's also, through him, who's also a government. So until the government gets behind it, I don't really see that while we can attempt in certain ways, because the whole culture is so dependent on interlocking parts, it's practically impossible for an isolated group of people like ourselves to actually achieve self-sufficiency, to actually demonstrate to the world the Vedic culture, while the rest of the world is going in the opposite direction. So until the powers of the world, or at least India or West Bengal, Nadia are sympathetic to the whole program, do you think it's practical that we can actually implement a Vedic-based lifestyle?
Well, I think that we, you know, Prabhupada said example is better than precept. And oftentimes would say, or at least sometimes said, that we should create an ideal, we should demonstrate, show by practical example an ideal unit of society. So many times these kinds of people are very busy and you just give them a book or whatever, it doesn't necessarily do much. But if they can come and see, your microphone needs to be switched on. If they can come and see people working according to, you know, Prabhupada's, Prabhupada gives this the examples of how in ISKCON he wanted us to develop one ashram. So it seems to me that by showing a practical demonstration on a small scale, then it becomes much easier to see. Oh, this makes sense. This works. There's something good here. I've been told some of the devotees that take people on tours around Mayapur, many times when they come and they see around the campus and everything, and then when they get to the Gurukula, they see something there that triggers something. They see some cultural thing there which they didn't see on this side. And immediately it starts to trigger things, and they start to, you know, they want to give donations quite you know, easily, because they see something that appeals to them in terms of tradition, in terms of something that they understand is authentic. So we need to, you know, Prabhupada at one point he wanted the devotees to come to India to experience what was left of Vedic culture. So if we can show that, and then we bring the government people in. So this is what I was saying, and you know, when Prabhupada was with us, he was regularly meeting government people. And at the same time, he bought the land, and he encouraged the devotees to develop one ashram. So he was doing these two things. He was meeting the people, and he was developing the projects. And then, just like with the planning officer of West Bengal, he wanted to bring him here and show him what we're doing. So it seems to me that both have to be there. It's no point in preaching to the people if we're not actually even making an attempt to talk, you know, to walk our talk, you know, to actually provide examples. But I agree with you at the same time, there's no point in just doing the examples if we don't bring the people in to see them and try to, you know, influence. So I think they both have to be there. We have to ourselves try to live up to what Prabhupada expected. He gives many instructions, do this, you know, get this land, you know, build cottages, live simply, demonstrate simple life. And at the same time, he would go and get the politicians, bring them back, preach to them and show them, look, this is what we're doing. So I feel that they both have to be there simultaneously. And then the influence will be there. Otherwise, you know, what hope is there?
Well, if we adopt a simple life on the Vedic lines, then our preaching will basically stop.
Not everybody. That's the thing. The amazing thing with our society is it encompasses so many aspects. So there are many aspects that we don't have to work on at all. We're, you know, when it comes to Harinam, for instance, maybe here in India, or you know, book distribution here in India, or so many in different countries, different things have more strength. Those things are going on, and they shouldn't be stopped. Swami's traveling in airplanes to different places. Don't stop it. Those things don't need to be stopped. I'm not arguing for that. I'm saying we need to add this element. That's all. Just add this element to our preaching, which we're not. We don't have much of that element. So just add that element. Everything else goes on. All these other things, that our modern methods of preaching, should carry on. You know, we use everything in Krishna service. But for people, the simple, common people, to be happy, there is a prescription of how they can be happy. And the modern system is not making happy people. You know, the people are not happy in general, and the system is not getting any better. So Prabhupada wanted to show how you can be happy, living simply, and then you just add Krishna consciousness to that. And actually, by living this simple life, it gives you more time for Krishna consciousness. And as far as I can see, that was Prabhupada's main thing. Save time for chanting Hare Krishna. By living simply, you save time for chanting Hare Krishna. When you have to work for some materialist who is interested in getting his maximum labor out of you for the minimum return, you have no time for Krishna consciousness. And neither are you happy. So, you know, that was Prabhupada's prescription. So, it seems to me that both have to be there. The whole panoply, you know, all the different things we do in ISKCON continue, plus add much more of this simple living and high thinking. Any other questions? Yes.
Haribol. 2 points. One point is because I am born in one island who, when I was a child, had no current, no running water, no facilities of modern civilization. And it was a holy place, and it had many monasteries, monks, and saints, and people in the caves who are practicing austerity. I have seen in the practice the demonstration how preaching can go on in parallel with the farming civilization. The same monks who were cultivating the land and the family-like people who were cultivating the land were the same people who were attending to the monastery, who were preaching, who were taking care of the pilgrims, and very nicely even. So that is very much possible when spiritual life is there. That is one point. And one point about government. Okay, it would be ideal that the government of the modern society will show interest for Varnashram, but if our own government inside ISKCON doesn't show interest, how can that government show interest? We should give example in the sense that we are simple devotees, we are simple family, we cannot become self-sufficient unless our own GBC establishes a system that we are working this way within the movement. If that we have the capacity to build such a temple and we have the funds to do it, then we should also have the capacity and the funds to develop what surrounds the temple. The temple should not be surrounded by a big market and some gardens for people to come here like a so-called transcendental Disneyland. It should be a big farming civilization around the temple who supports and maintains all this. And that is the example, no? And then people will appreciate. And the preaching will happen even in ways that I lived in farms in the past. People come in the farm and they want to work in the land. People who come from the city or who are, they want to come for the holidays and work in the land so that they can learn or they can understand or come in touch with this reality. So this is a very big preaching. The example is a big preaching. The spiritual life that goes on in a farm is a big preaching.
Mm-hmm. Mataji, you had a question?
It's just about the Manusamhita. What I have understood from reading the books is that what's applicable for Kali Yuga is the writings of Parasara Muni and also like the Vedic Samskar. We don't exactly follow the Vedic Samskar, but it's the Nara Pancharatra Samskar that we follow. So I read the first canto itself about Prabhupada said that we don't really understand the Vedas or practice the Vedas as such, but Mahabharata gives everything that's applicable for us in Kali Yuga. And if we just study Mahabharata, then we understand what's for us. Mm-hmm. And Srila Prabhupada's purport, like for example, the what's given from teachings of Bhishmadev, in the purport Prabhupada gives like a summary of what's applicable for us and how Shudras and everybody else are taken care of. That's as far as I understand. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, and Prabhupada specifically wanted us to develop Dagi Varnashram, which means Varnashram considering us as devotees. So we take the devotional aspect of everything. You know, we all of the different codes mentioned in the Shastras, we need to interpret them as a devotee would interpret them. So Prabhupada's given many instructions, and you know, when we follow Manusamhita, I mean, the interesting thing Prabhupada stresses here is Smriti. What is it? He says Shruti and Smriti. So you don't take the Smriti without the Shruti. You need the personal authority, guru, you know. So in this way, every one of us, we're fortunate in that we don't have to just speculate. We have the Shastra and we have our gurus. So in any particular time, place and circumstance, we apply the teachings according to our guru's instruction. So in different places, different things are appropriate. You know, we can manage different, we can have different strategies in different places, and also according to the persons that are delivering the strategy and who we're delivering it to. All these different things have to be considered. So Prabhupada would speak about these different aspects of these things to different people at different times. And then sometimes we have to also look at who was he speaking to, what was the circumstance surrounding it. So there are so many things to consider when applying the philosophy. And in every circumstance we have to see what is appropriate. You know, so we have these different authorities. So although the Shastra may have its approach, and there may be a certain certain apparently blanket statements are made, but then we filter into that. We take, you know, what our guru says, and what is the prevalent, what is good in this particular circumstance. So you know, we have to consider all these things. It's okay. All right, we better stop there. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.
Gracias.